Hi, I'm James Schilling Law, and I'm here with Jeffrey Weil, who's the founder and president of Weil, a travel public relations and marketing firm. And we're not here to talk about one of Jeffrey's clients, although we actually do talk with many of Jeffrey's clients over the time, but we're here to talk about Jeffrey himself and a new book that he has just written. It was just published. It's called All Abroad, Not All Abroad. It's subtitled A Memoir of Travel and Obsession. And we're going to find out about that book and why he wrote it. And it is a marvelous book, I got to tell you. It's very well written and some marvelous, and it is very much about travel. So we're going to end this and encourage you to go out and buy it. In any event, you're going to hear about all that and more from Jeffrey himself on Insider Travel Report. Now, Jeffrey, first of all, how are you and where are you? I believe you're still traveling. We can't get you off the road.
I'm still traveling. And actually, because of COVID, I realized that I can take a longer vacation than I normally do. And we're on a 6 weeks family vacation, and we're in the middle of it. We were in Dubai and the Maldives, and now we're in Israel, and I'm at the King David Hotel. And I'm enjoying traveling.
Yeah, no, and you did before. You went off on the road on your own. It was the first time, luckily, with the family. Last time, you were all over Italy and parts of Germany and a lot of great places. And we've been chronicling that in several of the columns you've written for us, which have been, you know, very well read. And I think people are just happy to see someone is out there and traveling, much as I am out there and traveling. But I got to tell you, I don't have a candle to you what you're doing in this six-week stint. I got to catch up. I got to go to more places.
Well, it is like last September, I decided, okay, enough. And I started. And I have to say that it's been fascinating. It's been eye-opening. And in a little very selfish way, to see certain parts of the world empty.
Yeah. Like
Venice, to see Venice empty, to see Rome empty is a very selfish, awful, terrible thing. It's kind of nice.
You're apologizing for, but you're also kind of secretly glad you did it, right?
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly. And I wanted to demonstrate to myself and to my colleagues and to my clients that we're alive and well, and travel hasn't died.
Right.
It's having a nap. But it's going to come back.
Well, I totally agree with you. And we're starting to come back despite all the worries now about the resurgence of new variants and things like that. But I think we're headed on a path that is really, there's no going back, so to speak. So it's just going to keep growing. Now, let's get to the heart of the matter of this, because we're talking about some of the columns that you've written for us. But this book that you've just put out, All Abroad, really is a story of your life, but it's much more than that. So can you briefly describe the book, what it focuses on, and really tell our viewers what it's all about?
I think, to precy it, it is a memoir of a little boy who had an outwardly very happy childhood, but an inwardly very unhappy childhood in many ways. Mm-hmm. And the way I sought to escape from that unhappiness was to read about travel, talk about travel, and eventually to travel. And that's really how the book came about. And I mean, I wanted to write a memoir. I suppose that's
right.
Part of it, but it is travel is what and who I am.
Right.
And, as a kid, my brother left home when I was 8 and left me all his National Geographic magazines.
Oh, that's dangerous, because then you get incentivized too. And I believe he left for Israel, if I recall.
Yes, he did.
Yeah.
And I wasn't really interested in the articles. I was interested in the ads. And the ads were mostly about travel, or they were about America. And I grew up in England, obviously, in post-war London. I was born in the last day of 1949, so I grew up in the 50s. And London was still very blitz, still right. very austere. And these views of the world and of America were so seductive and so exciting that that's really what got me going. Plus, I came from a family of travelers. My father, right. my father talked about travel, talked about, I mean, we talked about cars and trains, and he had traveled a lot as a young man. And my mother was born in Australia and came to England when she was 9 and was torpedoed on the way to England. So
that's amazing.
I grew up hearing these tales. Plus I have relatives in France and in America and Australia and South Africa and Israel and Germany. And so traveling to me was not, it was something that one did. It wasn't an adventure that was unreachable, but it was something that I grew to be incredibly passionate about.
No, absolutely. Yeah, it's very evident in the pages of this book that, you know, you have, you call it an obsession with travel, and is very much a part of that. I mean, you collected travel posters as a boy. You loved cars. I love cars. You loved the, and in fact, one of the things that's apparent is that you look at travel a little bit differently than maybe others might. You talk a little about it this, it's really more of a focus. You focus on the mechanics of travel sometimes, the trains, the ships, the aircraft, the cars, maybe rather, sometimes more than the destinations and attractions themselves.
Totally. Yeah. My dad taught me how to read a red Michelin guide when I was about 6. Mm-hmm. Never a green one, which was all about the sites and the cathedrals and the museums. Right, right. It was all about the hotels and the restaurants and he talked about the boats and the trains and my favorite bar mitzvah present was a subscription to the OAG, the airline guide.
Oh yeah.
I got this tome, you know, once a month, and I would read it like I was reading the Bible. Except it was more interesting than the Bible.
No, absolutely. My dad collected Michelin Red Guides, which is how he would plan all his trips.
Exactly.
And then he'd go down to the travel agency and get his airline tickets and his car rental. But he'd actually write away to all the hotels that he was going to go to based on the information from Michelin Red Guides. And then he would wait to get responses in the mail. So he could actually go do it. So that's the way we traveled back then, and I was very much a part of that. We went all over Europe, to, you know, with them. But your book very much reminded my own childhood, going around and traveling like crazy, and actually being obsessed kind of with the mechanics, the trains. I mean, you know, the York Railway Museum is still one of my favorite places in the world. You know, this kind of thing. So, but you did it. You wrote about this, and I think it's fascinating.
Well, Yeah, I did, and I started my career at the very low end, almost in the mailroom at Thomas Cook.
Well, we're going to talk about that because you were a travel advisor. We call them that. You are a travel agent, and let's talk a little bit about that because you do talk about that in the book quite a lot.
I mean, I started in London in a wholesale department, putting together tours for people who were taking their cars to Europe. But eventually I wrangled my way to being transferred from London to New York, mm-hmm. which was a whole adventure in itself. And I was, in those days, Thomas Cook had its main office on Fifth Avenue and 48th right. Street. And it was this very grand place to which people came to book their trips. People just walked off the street to book a world cruise. It's unheard of nowadays, but people right. just, you know, Thomas Cook was the name. It was the name you trusted. And we were the purveyors of that trust. And it was quite exciting. People would walk in and I eventually became head salesman at Thomas Cook, and I was the first person ever to do $1 million sales in a year. This was 1974.
And that's still pretty good today, I got to tell you.
Well, then it was very good.
And, I'm sure.
It was so good that I got promoted into management.
Right.
Which I hated, because I was busy dealing with opening offices and closing offices and staff and all of that stuff. And I wasn't interested. I was interested in booking people in hotels, sure, and booking them on the SS France or the Queen Elizabeth II, or the Concorde.
Okay.
And I wasn't interested in being upstairs, being a manager. And that's why eventually I moved on. But it those were the grand days of, you know, there were no deals in those days. All the airline fares were the same.
Sure.
There were no discounts. Certainly at Thomas Cook, there were no discounts. And you just booked people on the best planes and the best hotels and the best ships. And it was fun.
Yeah, no, I can imagine. So now, how did you make the transition from being a travel advisor? You went to management, then got out, and you ended up being a marketing and communication specialist. And someone I've known since I was in the industry. You've had a firm, you know, you're really a veteran, a PR, we'll say, a travel PR person. Yeah, how did that happen?
It happened because I was really bored in management.
Right.
And I was walking up Fifth Avenue and I ran into the director of the Israel Tourist Office, who I had met.
Right.
We weren't that close, but I'd met him and we were chatting. And he said, "It's interesting, we're looking for a PR manager. If you know of anybody, you know, let me know." And then we chatted a bit more and I walked on. And by the time I got to Saks, it kind of hit me that there is probably nobody who knows Israel better, because by this time my brother lived there and I'd visited 100 times and I knew travel pretty well. And I didn't know what the hell PR was, but I figured I could learn it.
Okay.
And I applied and I got the job, and that's how it began.
And then you end up eventually leaving and forming your own firm and representing a lot of other people in the travel industry, not just Israel.
Absolutely. But to be fair, the Israelis came to me and said, "We can't afford you as an employee, but we could have, if you start your own firm, we can afford you."
Okay.
But don't make a mistake. Don't rely on one client. And I went out and got others, and that's how it built.
No, and in fact, you've gotten lots of hotels. I know you're visiting a lot of your clients now and going out all around because you have a very nice stable of very upscale clients with hotels and destinations and things like that. And I first knew you by the association with Israel, and I think I took some of your trips that you organized for press. And they were marvelous. It really introduced me to the country. And I was in Israel, I don't know, 6 times over about a decade. So that was a great way to get introduced to it. Now, let's talk a little bit about some of your, kind of give us a couple of your favorite stories from the book, especially those defining moments when you talk about how as a child, you travel basically became the focus of your life.
Well, when I was 6, we went on a car trip to Europe. And incredibly, I remember it as if it were not yesterday, but I remember details of it because of this obsession that I had developed that a normal 6-year-old, I mean, I have 3 kids and they've all been 6, and I know they don't have the memories of traveling that I did.
Right.
Not because they haven't been anywhere, but because it wasn't so central to their being. But I know exactly where we stayed and which hotels. At the age of 6, we stayed at a succession of hotels on our way to Lake Como. So that was clearly a very defining moment.
And you talk about the detail, because, and you have to, you really must read the book, because it's, you have an incredible eye for detail, and the descriptions that you have of places and that you went to, how you got there, and it's really fascinating. And then how you relate that to all your real obsession with travel, which is quite clear from the book. But I remember that passage when you were talking about that trip and the traveling to Paris and then Como, and it's just marvelous. And it brought back memories for me, because I had some similar experiences when I was not six, but probably I did travel when I was six or seven, but it really, my defining was probably 12 when I really remember things, and like coming back on the SS France, things like that.
Right. Well, that you would remember.
Yeah, it's great, and it's wonderful memories, and maybe, just maybe, it's why I do what I do today. Who knows?
As you do. I think it could have a lot to do with it.
I think so. But talk about some other, another passage in the book that really evokes that.
Well, you know, on that trip, okay, we were on Lake Como, and we were taken to a villa where somebody I'd never heard of at the age of six, called Benito Mussolini, mm-hmm, spent his last night with his mistress, and we were taken up to his bedroom. And this is 1956. I mean, this was 11 years afterwards. It wasn't, you know, ancient history.
Sure.
And this elderly, ancient woman took us upstairs to his bedroom and opened a trunk and removed a hand towel that had his handprints on it. And she treated it like it was the Shroud of Turin and showed it to us. And it had tears in her eyes. And then she took us down to the gate where he and his mistress were shot. So that, you know, that went right into my mind. I also on that trip, we went to the village in Germany where my grandfather grew up.
Right.
He came to London in 1899, but his family remained in Germany into the 30s. And the synagogue in this little town was still the wreck that it had been turned into on Crystal Night.
Right.
In 1938. And I remember that, and I remember visiting my grandmother's grave, which was in the little village next door. I remember crossing the Atlantic on the old Queen Elizabeth.
The first one, right?
The first one. And my dad, who was interested in the mechanics of travel, wasn't interested in too much in the details. All he cared about was that we had a private bathroom.
My that is true. They didn't always have those, even then.
Well, yeah, he couldn't care less where the cabin was, what it was, as long as it had a private bathroom. And it turned out that in those days there was first class, there was cabin class, and there was tourist class.
Right.
And we were in tourist class, and my aunt in America, whom we had visited, was shocked and horrified that we would be returning in tourist class, which turned out to be pretty crappy, actually. But our cabin was a cabin class cabin. So
got it. With a bathroom. With a bathroom.
Right, with a bathroom. But all of the fancy clothes that my parents had packed were not needed.
I see. Well, you know, people see the movie The Titanic, and they forget that there were classes on these ships. And
ooh, yeah.
The first ship I went on, which was the SS France, had three classes, the first class and second class, and they didn't call it steerage. I think they actually called it third class. We were lucky enough, because our trip was sponsored by my dad's company, to be in first class. And so I never knew anything worse. You know, it's like I was spoiled from the beginning. And, you know, as much caviar as you want, fine. They just spooned it out. That was a different era, right?
It was. And I hate the word spoiled, because to me, something can never be unspoiled once it's spoiled. So
got it.
I never use that word, but you were certainly indulged.
Indulged, this is true. Now, in your view, how has travel changed over the course of your career? What are some of the major inflection points when the industry sort of hit a major change? And
well, I think I hit upon one earlier, in that price is a factor that it never was.
Right.
In that, if you wanted to fly to Europe, there was first class or economy, and that was it. The idea that different airlines would have different fares, or there would be EasyJet or Ryanair or right. Spirit Airlines or JetBlue had not been thought of. I think that it has become very homogenized in some ways, particularly with the development of the Starwoods and now Marriott, which right. kind of almost owns everything. Although I will say, I just stayed at the Ritz-Carlton in Dubai with my family, and we don't represent them, so I'm not trying to push anybody. It was really splendid, and it didn't feel like I was in a chain hotel. It felt right. like I was in a really good hotel. I think it's certainly, obviously, the cruise business has gone through the roof.
Absolutely.
Totally changed. You know, when I started selling travel at Thomas Cook in the 70s, people would take these European tours that were, you know, 8 countries in 2 weeks. And that's kind of been replaced by the cruise, in a way, that you can visit 8 ports and not even have to unpack. And so that has, the tour business is very different than it was.
Right, right. Well, even the tour business today, they're trying to make sure they realize that you're not in the bus business. You know, they want to mm-hmm. give you experiences, and, you know, the days of if it's Tuesday, it must be Belgium, which I think you actually mentioned in the book.
I do.
Which I barely remember the movie, except when I see it repeats on Turner Classic or something. But it wasn't a very good movie, and for some reason,
but it was. It really did portray yeah. a real phenomenon that was how Americans traveled.
That was right, right.
And, yeah. and we don't travel that way anymore.
No, and in fact, it's been the bane of the tour industry ever since. As I remember talking to USTUA's old president, Bob Whitley, who was like, we have to destroy that perception that was so strong that it was just, yeah. you know, a destination a day and get on the bus and just moving on. And those tours still exist, but they really have tried to focus more on the experiential, and that actually has been a major change in travel too. I mean, it was always there, but, you know, we didn't really say, well, you have to experience, it's not even called experiential now, it's called transformational, right? It's we have to be transformed by travel, right?
Exactly. And there was, I developed a realization when I was at that counter at Thomas Cook. We now call it a bucket list, but in those right. days, that word, that expression didn't exist, but I realized that people did have this list up in their brain, or sometimes even written down, of the places they wanted to have been to. They didn't particularly want to go to them, and they didn't really want to. They wanted to have been.
Right.
To get it off the list. And actually, I suppose that still exists in a way. But I realized how central that was to the way people looked upon where they were going to go next.
No, absolutely. Yeah. No,
and that still exists.
Yeah, I mean, I think what's happened though is that there is the bucket list, but there's also the bragging rights, the experiential. I've done something that nobody else has done, or very few people has done, and I think that's emerged. Again, it was always there. But it's just now kind of the main focus. It's not just a bucket list. And although I personally have bucket lists of destinations I want to go to that, sure. believe it or not, I still haven't gone to. But
I do too.
Yeah. And it's, everybody thinks we've been everywhere since we're in the industry, but there are always a few that, and surprise you. And then of course you always get those people saying, well, what's your favorite this? And you're like, you know, tell me at the moment. It's really the moment. It's the moment of you know, what's my favorite island? Well, I can name a few. What's my favorite city? I can name a few. And what's my favorite hotel? It's just tough to do that.
Very hard.
And as like I said, I once told a good buddy of mine, you know him too, James Ruja, who wrote with me back in the day, is that we need to have an old age home for travel writers, travel journalists, travel PR people, because nobody can stand our stories after a while, right?
Right.
Well, but here you've written the story. This is the whole thing. You have this story, and it's an amazing book. Actually, that goes, what do you want people to get out of this book? What should be the takeaway?
The takeaway should be, I listen, I'm not exactly sure what the takeaway is, but it certainly is a story about how travel has developed and changed, and a personal story of how it changed me and made me who I am, I suppose. And I reflect a lot in the book about right. history, about how travel, one of the points I make in the book is how we look back on the 30s, for instance, right. the 1930s, of the glamorous golden age of travel with these beautiful posters of trains and ships. But when you think of the reality, the 30s were really terrible. It was the Spanish Civil War. It was the rise of Hitler.
Correct.
It was the rise of
Mussolini. Mussolini, right.
It was refugees trying to find a place that would take them. And yet we look back on it as this era of glory and glamour and wonder, which if you were a moneyed American or a moneyed British person, it was. But if you were a Jew in Germany or a poor person in Poland or a worker in Scotland, it was pretty terrible.
Right, right.
And yet we look back on it as being so glorious. And the big change after the war, after the Second World War, was that travel became available to eventually the masses.
Right.
With all the good things that that has brought, and all the, if you're a travel snob like I kind of am, and like you probably are, some of the bad things. But
that's right.
Travel has, and then of course something happened in Wuhan, and we're in a little era when travel has changed monumentally. But
yeah, this is in my lifetime, it's the biggest effect on travel, certainly for my business, it's just for all the travel businesses. And it is different, although thankfully we're emerging. But I wanted to go back to something you said, that you know, how we idealize travel. And you're talking about the ads you would see in American publications, and ads for, you know, you see these amazing things that people are traveling, and in travel posters too, which you were a collector of, I believe.
Right.
And so this is the idealized version of travel that you're talking about in the book, and really kind of what spurred you on to go explore yourself, right?
Exactly. Yeah. Totally. And I, as a kid, as a teenager, I went to a very fancy public school, which is a private school in right. England. But it was a day school. It wasn't a boarding school. And Wednesday afternoons were free. And I would take the tube to Piccadilly Circus, and I would go from one tourist office and one airline office to collect posters. And I would put them up in my room and collect them. And now I'm a collector of, I wish I'd kept most of them. Of course, I didn't. And that's the whole point of why collecting travel posters is so fascinating, because they weren't made to be kept. They weren't made to be framed and
right.
halogen lit. They were meant to be, you know, smeared onto a wall or onto a billboard or a railway station column. And that's why so few of them survived.
Yeah.
And why those that did are valuable and beautiful.
No, and I have a few of myself. I have the one you actually have illustrations of some of these posters in the book, and I hit the one with the Normandy, which is, you know, which has been imitated many times since by some other cruise lines, but right. it really is, you know, it's so colorful. And I did for a while when I actually had an office. I've been working remotely forever. So
what's an office?
What's an office? It's right here. It's right here. It's by, you know, behind you, and it's right where you are. You know, it's as I tell people around the world, I said, this is my office for today. And they all like, oh, wow, that's great. I said, I don't have that. But when I did have an office, I decorated with old travel posters. So, and that was back, you know, back in the late 90s or early 2000s. And one of those was the Normandy. And I still have it somewhere in my bedroom here. But it's idealization of travel. But I think that's good, because it really gets us thinking about these incredible places that we want to go to.
Exactly.
And get us thinking about the bucket list. Now, I was, as I mentioned earlier, extremely impressed by the quality of your writing, which didn't come as a surprise. And I've seen your writing. I've edited your writing. Your attention to detail, you're kind of linking your youth experiences to adult experiences. Is that something that really readers should really get out of?
A lot of people have told me who have read the book that they are astonished by the detail that I
me too.
Have had a movie camera whirring in my head when I was 6 and 7 and 8 and 9 and 10. So I suppose that's part of it. There's quite a lot of emotion in the book. There's one big reveal in the book, which I'm not going to.
No, well, you have to buy. You have to buy the book. I'm not going to say it here either, but I you have to buy the book.
In describing that reveal, I purposefully kind of interwove it with a way of delaying it, and it was all travel related. I read a lot, and part of my joy of reading is not only I read mostly nonfiction, and I'm most attracted by books whose writing is what I call beautiful. The facts are obviously important, but the style and the wit and the language to me is very important. Mm-hmm. And I think that comes out, I hope it comes out in my book. And that's why, I've been writing this book for quite a while. And I had sent
all your life, essentially.
Well, in a way. But I had sent it to some agents, and they all said, the writing is beautiful, but we're not sure it would sell. And eventually, the University of Wisconsin Press received it and loved it. And they were the ones that really persuaded me to finish it, because I hadn't. Once I had that that kind of backing and that imprimatur, it gave me the guts to finish it. And there are things now that I wish I had put in the book. A few things I wish I hadn't. But that's, the way the world is.
Yeah. Now, and you're still traveling. Are you contemplating a sequel? Because you're still
I'm contemplating it, but I'm not sure. Yes, I sort of am. Yes.
Well, you're writing a bunch of columns that don't really deal with your as right now. In fact, I think today we have one of your columns up on your current travels, and it's really fascinating. It's, again, the writing is great, and you don't pull any punches. You talk about exactly what's going on these trips, and I think
I call it, as traveling in the time of Corona, and it is a moment in time that will be forgotten, hopefully. but it is a unique moment in time, and I'm really enjoying chronicling the detail of it, the mask wearing or the not mask. I'll give you a perfect example. I'm staying at the King David Hotel. I'm an American. Tourists are not allowed into Israel at the moment, but my wife is American, therefore I'm allowed in. But because I'm American, I needed a COVID test to stay in a hotel here. I needed it within 72 hours of checking in today. Except that nobody asked for it when I got here. there's a lot of that.
Yeah, I know. I've experienced that myself about this testing regime. And, I was at I was heading to Istanbul and then on to Croatia just 3 weeks ago. And I arrived with my 72-hour PCR test, and the check-in agent said, "Oh no, that's no good," because she's leafing through reams of paper. What does it take if I have to go through Istanbul to Croatia? And finally, she says, "No, you have to get an antigen test, and there's one in the corner right here." So I went over, got my antigen test for $179, by the way.
Uh-huh.
And when I walked back, she was gone. And the gentleman who checked me in just took my PCR test. So, what is going on here? I was like, this is crazy, Simon. And again, I'm about ready to go traveling. As you're on the road, I will be on the road again soon. and I got to get my 72-hour PCR test, and they're not always easy to find all the time. I do have the record on a test, though. I went from Split in Croatia. I got my test there, PCR. That took me to Turkey. I got in there. That was with that PCR. That same PCR the next day got me into America, and the next day it got me into St. Martin. I'm going to claim the record for that.
That certainly is, I think, the Guinness Book of Records.
I think I'm certainly a contender. You may beat me soon, but we'll see what happens. Now let's just close this up. But is there anything else you want to tell our readers about all abroad and what else they should know about this book?
I think they need to understand that it is all about travel, but it is all about a person that found an escape and found redemption in a way through travel. I grew up with a collection of traumatic experiences, as do most people, although some not quite as traumatic as a couple that I describe, that are travel related and family related. And I would say that travel kind of kept me sane.
Right, right.
And that's why back in 2020, traveling was so important. And in fact, the book ends in February 2020 when I'm on a trip to Switzerland, and we were just beginning to know, we were beginning to wash our hands all the time. We weren't yet up to mask, but we knew something was amiss. And interestingly, I was in St. Moritz on that trip, and I had considered taking a day trip to northern Italy, to Lake Como and to Milan, and interestingly to Bergamo, which turned out to be to be COVID-19 central.
The point zero there, absolutely.
The worst. And luckily, or not luckily, I don't know, I didn't go and I didn't get COVID. And as yet, I still haven't had it, a bit unlike you who did.
It's not fun, I'll tell you that much.
It's not fun, as I hear, as I see and know and have learned. But I do know that COVID has not stopped me traveling, and it won't. But I think the book just is it talks about the glory of what travel can be, and it takes away. I mention in the book something I learned at Thomas Cook, that photography and group travel was invented at the same time, and they both would have been invented without the other, but each other encouraged the other. In other words, people went on tours and they took photographs.
Right.
The French word for remember is souvenir, and we do travel so much to look back on it, and the 5 minutes we spend outside Notre Dame doesn't have nearly as much impact on us as the years of looking back at the photograph of you outside Notre Dame. And so learning what travel can be as it happens, but also how it can be part of your memory is, to me, so what is so fabulous about it.
No, absolutely. Well, how can our viewers, here's the key, purchase the book? I assume it's on Amazon.
Amazon, it's at Barnes & Noble, it's out there.
Yeah, and so when are you going to sell the movie rights?
When somebody wants to buy them.
Anyway, Jeffrey, I want to thank you for taking the time. Here it is. Am I doing it right way? All Abroad. And you can get it now, and it really is a marvelous book, and you got to buy it. If only because Jeffrey was one of you. He was a travel agent, travel advisor at Thomas Cook. Back in that golden era, and he's been really promoting travel and the benefits of travel ever since. And now he's out there pretty much being a pathfinder for us. I'm trying to do the same, to say you can travel, you can get out there, even amid this crisis, the last year and a half almost. and we all can get back sooner than that. But Jeffrey, thank you very much for speaking with us today.
All the best. Thank you, James.
We'll see you, Jeffrey. Safe travels and on the road, and we'll see you soon someday in New York. I don't know, maybe you're never going to come back.
Oh, yeah. I'm
okay. I'm James Schillinglaw, and this is Insider Travel Report.